an hour northeast of Denver, which was close enough. Stiff from travel, he found yet another motel and crashed for the night. This time he was able to watch and enjoy some American TV, including a recap of the NFL season on ESPN. It was surprising how much he'd missed football. Almost as surprising as how much he'd missed having a drink whenever he wanted. That craving was fixed with a bottle of Jack Daniels he'd gotten along the way. By midnight he was feeling pretty mellow, looking around at his surroundings, glad to be back in America, and also glad for the reason he was back. It was time for some payback. Russell had not forgotten who had once owned Colorado, and he hadn't forgotten the massacre at Sand Creek. It should have been expected. Things had gone too smoothly, and reality does not often allow perfection. A small mistake in one of the fittings for the primary had been detected, and that fitting had to be removed and remachined, a process that set them back by 30 hours, of which 40 minutes had been required for the machining and the rest for disassembly and reassembly of the weapon. Frome, who should have been philosophical, had been livid during the whole procedure and insisted on doing the fix himself. Then had come the laborious replacement of the explosive blocks, all the more onerous for having already been done once. "Only 3 millimeters," Gone noted. Just a mistaken setting on one of the controls. Since it had been a manual job, the computers hadn't caught it. One of Frome's figures had been misread, and the first visual inspection of the assembly hadn't caught it. And we had that extra day. Frome merely grumbled behind his protective mask as he and Gone lifted the plutonium assembly and gently set it in place. 5 minutes later, it was clear that they had it correctly located. The bars of tungsten rhenium next fit into their own places, then the beryllium segments, and finally, the heavy, depleted uranium hemisphere that separated the primary from the secondary. 50 more explosive blocks, and they were done. Frome ordered a pause. What they had just accomplished was heavy work, and he wanted a short rest. The machinists were already gone, their services no longer required. "They should have been done by now," the German said quietly. "It is unreasonable to expect perfection, Manfred. The ignorant bastard couldn't read. The number on the plans was smudged. And that was your fault," Gone did not have to say. "Then he should have asked." "As you say, Manfred. You pick a poor time to be impatient. We are on schedule." The young Arab just didn't understand, Frome knew. The culmination of his life's ambitions, and it should have been done by now. Come on. It required 10 additional hours until the 70th and last explosive block sat in its resting place. Gone attached its wire lead to the proper terminal, and that was that. He extended his hand to the German, who took it.
"Congratulations, Herr Dr. Frome."
"Yeah. Thank you, Herr Gone. Now we need only to weld the case shut, draw the vacuum... the tritium. How did I forget that?"
"Who does the welding?" Manfred asked.
"I will. I'm very good at that."
The top half of the bomb case had a wide flange to ensure the safety of that procedure, and it had already been checked for a perfect fit. The machinists had not merely handled the precise work on the explosive part of the device. Every single part, except for the single mistrimmed fitting, had been cut and shaped to Frome's specifications, and the bomb case had already been checked. It fit as tightly as the back of a watch.
"Doing the tritium is easy."
"Yes, I know."
Gone motioned for the German to go outside.
"You are fully satisfied with the design and the assembly?"
"Completely," Frome said confidently. "It will function exactly as I predict."
"Excellent," Cotty said, waiting outside with one of his bodyguards. Frome turned, noting the commander's presence, along with one of his ubiquitous guards. Dirty, scruffy people. But he had to admire them, Frome told himself as he turned to look at the darkened valley. There was a quarter moon,
and he could just make out the landscape. So dry and harsh it was. Not these people's fault that they looked as they did. The land here was hard, but the sky was clear. Frome looked up at the stars on this cloudless night. More stars than one could see in Germany, especially the eastern part, with all its air pollution. And he thought about astrophysics, the path he might have taken, so closely related to the path he had. Gone stood behind the German. He turned to Cotty and nodded. The commander made the same gesture to his bodyguard, whose name was Abdullah. "Just the tritium remains," Frome said, his back to them. "Yes," Gone said. "I can do that myself." Frome was about to say that there was one more thing. He let it wait a moment, and didn't pay attention to Abdullah's footsteps. There was no sound at all as the guard removed a silenced pistol from his belt and pointed it at Frome's head from a range of 1 meter. Frome began to turn, to make sure that Gone knew about the tritium, but he never made it around. Abdullah had his orders. It was supposed to be merciful, as it had been for the machinists. It was a pity that it had been necessary at all, Cotty thought, but it was necessary, and that was that. None of that mattered to Abdullah, who merely followed his orders, squeezing on the trigger smoothly and expertly until the round fired. The bullet entered the back of Frome's skull, soon thereafter exiting through his forehead. The German dropped in a crumpled mass. Blood fountained out, but sideways, without reaching Abdullah's clothing. The guard waited until the blood flow stopped, then summoned 2 comrades to carry the body to the waiting truck. He'd be buried with the machinists. That, at least, was fitting, Cotty thought. All the experts in the same place. "A pity," Gone observed quietly. "Yes. But do you really think we would have further use of him?" Ibrahim shook his head. "No. He would have been a liability. We could not trust him. An infidel and a mercenary. He fulfilled his contract."
"And the device?"
"It will work. I have checked the numbers 20 times. It is far better than anything I might have designed."
"What's this about tritium?"
"In the batteries. I only need to heat them up and bleed off the gas. Then the gas is pumped into the 2 reservoirs. You know the rest."
Cotty grunted. "You have explained it, but I do not know it."
"This part of the job is work for a high school chemistry lab. No more than that. Simple."
"Why did Frome leave it for last?"
Gone shrugged. "Something has to be last. This is an easy task rather than a hard one. Perhaps that is why."
"I can do it now, if you wish."
"Good."
Cotty watched the procedure. One after another, Gone loaded the batteries into the furnace, which he set for very low heat. A metal tube and a vacuum pump drew off the gas emitted by each in turn. It took less than an hour.
"Frome lied to us," Gone observed when he was done.
"What?"
Cotty asked in alarm. "Commander, there is almost 15% more tritium than he promised." "So much the better."
The next step was even simpler. Gone carefully checked that each reservoir was air and pressure tight. It was the 6th such test. The young engineer had learned from his German teacher, then transferred the tritium gas. The valves were closed and locked shut with cotter pins so that any vibration in transit could not open them.
"Finished," Gone announced.
The guards lifted the top of the bomb case and lowered it into place from an overhead winch. It fit precisely into place. Gone took an hour to weld it shut. Another test confirmed that the bomb case was pressure tight. He next attached a labeled vacuum pump to the case.
"What exactly do you need to achieve?"
"A 1/1000th of an atmosphere is what we specified."
"Can you do that? Won't it harm?"
Gone spoke not unlike Frome, surprising the both of them.
"Commander, please. All that presses in is air. It does not crush you, and it will not crush this steel case, will it?" It will take a few hours, and we can also test the integrity of the bomb case again. Which had also been done 5 times. Even without being welded, the case held well. Now one piece of metal, it would be as perfect as the mission required.
We can get some sleep. It doesn't hurt the pump to run.
When will it be ready to transport?
In the morning.
When is the ship leaving?
2 days.
There you have it. Gone smiled broadly.
Time to spare.
First, Marvin visited the local branch of Colorado Federal Bank and Trust Company. He amazed and delighted the branch vice president by placing a call to England and having $500,000 transferred by wire. Computers made things so much easier. In seconds, he had confirmation that Mr. Robert Friend was every bit as substantial as he claimed to be.
"Can you recommend a good local realtor?" Russell asked the very solicitous banker.
"Right down the street, third door on the right. I'll have your checks ready when you get back." The banker watched him leave and placed a rapid phone call to his wife, who worked in the real estate office. She was waiting for him at the door.
"Mr. Friend, welcome to Rogan."
"Thank you. Good to be back."
"You've been away?"
"Spent some time in Saudi Arabia," Russell slash Friend explained. "But I missed my winters."
"What are you looking for?"
"Oh, a medium-sized ranch, place where I might raise some beef."
"House? Barns?"
"Yeah, a good-sized house. Not that big, don't need it. There's just me, you see. Say about 3,000 square feet. I can go smaller for good land."
"You originally from around here?"
"The Dakotas, actually. But I need to be close to Denver for the transportation. Air travel, I mean. I do a lot of that. My old homestead is too far from things."
"Will you want help to run your ranch?"
"Yeah, I'll need that. Say a place big enough for 2 hands. Maybe a couple. I really should have a place closer to town, but damn it, I just want a place where I can eat my own beef."
"I know what you mean," the realtor agreed. "I have a couple of places you might like."
"Then let's go see them." Russell smiled at the lady.
The second one was perfect. Just off exit 50, 500 acres, a nice old farmhouse with a new kitchen, a 2-car garage, and 3 sturdy outbuildings. There was clear land in all directions, a pond with some trees 1/2 mile from the house, and plenty of room for the cattle that Russell would never see.
"This one's been on the market for 5 months. The owner's estate is asking $400,000, the realtor said. "But we can probably get them to go for $350,000.
"Okay," Russell said, checking access to Interstate 76. "Tell them if they sign the contract this week, I'll make a $50,000 cash deposit. Settlement in, oh, say, 4 or 5 weeks. No problem on financing. I'll pay cash for the whole thing when I get the rest of my funds transferred. But I want to start moving in immediately. God, I hate living in hotels. Done way too much of that. You think we get all that done?"
The realtor beamed at him.
"I think I can guarantee it."
"Great. So, how did the Broncos do this year?"
8-8. They're rebuilding.
My husband and I have season tickets. You going to try and get tickets for the Super Bowl?"
"I'd sure like to."
"Going to be pretty hard," the realtor warned him.
"I'll find a way."
An hour and 1 telephone call later, the realtor took a cashier's check for $50,000 from her banker husband. Russell had directions to the local furniture and appliance store. After an hour there, Marvin purchased a white Ford van from the local dealership and drove it to the ranch. He parked it in one of the barns. He'd be keeping the rental for a while. He would spend 1 more night in the motel, then settle into his new house. He did not feel any sense of accomplishment. There was much left to do.
Kathy Ryan found herself paying closer attention to the newspapers now. They were good for reporting scandals and leaks, and she now had the interest in such things that she had lacked before, especially for the byline of Robert Holtzman. Unfortunately, the new articles on the problems at CIA were more general, concentrating mainly on changes within the Soviet Union that she had difficulty understanding. It just wasn't an area in which she had much interest, as Jack didn't much care about the developments in eye surgery that his wife was very excited about. Finally, there did come a piece about financial impropriety and a very senior official. That was the second such item, and she realized that if it was Jack, she had all the investigatorial documents there in her own home. It was a Sunday, and Jack was away at work again, leaving her at home with the kids again. The kids enjoyed this chilly morning in front of the TV. Kathy Ryan went into the financial files. They were a disaster. Money management was another thing that failed to interest Dr. Carolyn Ryan, and Jack assumed the duties more or less by default, just as cooking fell into her domain. She didn't even know the filing system, and was certain that Jack never expected her to wade into this colossal mess of documents. Along the way, she learned that the blind trust that managed their stock portfolio was doing rather well at the moment. Ordinarily, she just saw the year-end earnings statements. Money didn't interest her very much. The house was paid off. The kids' education funds were already set up. The Ryan family actually lived off the combined income of the two doctors Ryan, which allowed their investments to grow while complicating their annual taxes, which was also something that Jack, CPA certification or not, took care of with the aid of the family's attorney. The most recent statement of net worth drew a gasp. Kathy decided to add the money managers to the Christmas card list, but that was not what she was after. She found it at 2:30 in the afternoon. The file was simply marked Zimmer, and was naturally enough in the last drawer she got to. The Zimmer file was several inches thick. She sat cross-legged on the floor before opening it, her head already aching from eye strain and the Tylenol which she should have taken but hadn't. The first document was a letter from Jack to an attorney. Not their regular attorney, the one who did their wills and taxes and other routine work, instructing him to set up an educational trust fund for 7 children, a number which had been changed to 8 several months later, Kathy saw. The trust fund had been set up with an initial investment of over $500,000 and managed as a stock portfolio through the same managers who did part of the Ryan family account. Kathy was surprised to see that Jack did actually make recommendations for this account, something that he did not do for his own. He hadn't lost his touch either. The yield from the Zimmer portfolio was 23%. Another $100,000 had been invested in a business, a subchapter S corporation, she saw, whatever that was, with Southland Corporation as, oh, she realized, a 7-Eleven. It was a Maryland corporation, with the address given as, that's only a few miles from here. It was, in fact, right off of Route 50, and that meant that Jack passed it twice a day on his way to and from work. How convenient. So who the hell was Carol Zimmer? Medical bills? Obstetrics? Dr. Marcia Rosen? I know her. Had Kathy not been on the faculty at Hopkins, she would have used Marcia Rosen for her own pregnancies. Rosen was a Yale graduate with a very fine reputation. A baby? Jacqueline Zimmer? Jacqueline, Kathy thought, her face flushed scarlet. Then the tears began streaming down her cheeks. You bastard. You can't give me a baby, but you gave one to her, didn't you? She checked the date, then searched her memory. Jack hadn't been home that day until very late. She remembered, because she'd had to cancel out on a dinner party over it. He was there. He was there for the delivery, wasn't he? What more proof do I need? The triumph of the discovery changed at once into black despair. The world could end so easily, Kathy thought. Just a slip of paper could do it. And that was it. It was over. Is it over? How could it not be?
even if he still wanted. Did she want him?
What about the kids? Kathy asked herself. She closed the file and replaced it without rising.
You're a doctor, she said to herself. You're supposed to think before you act.
The kids needed a father. But what sort of father was he? Gone 13 or 14 hours a day, sometimes 7 days a week. He managed to take his son to one, just one baseball game despite constant pleas. He was lucky to make half of Little Jack's t-ball games. He missed every school affair, the Christmas plays, all the other things. Kathy had been half surprised that he'd been home Christmas morning. The night before, assembling the toys, he'd gotten drunk again, and she hadn't even bothered trying to attract him. What was the point? His present to her, well, it was nice enough, but the sort of thing a man could get in a few minutes of shopping, no big deal. Shopping. Kathy rose and checked through the mail on Jack's desk. His credit card bills were sitting in the pile. She opened one and found a bunch of entries from Hamleys in London. $600? But he'd only gotten one thing for little Jack and two small items for Sally. $600? Christmas shopping for two families, Jack? Just how much more evidence do you need, Kathy girl? She asked herself aloud again. Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God. She didn't move for a very long time, nor did she see or hear anything outside of her own misery. Only the mother in her kept subconscious track of the sound of the kids in the playroom. Jack got home just before 7 that evening, actually rather pleased with himself to be an hour early, and further pleased that he had the Mexico operation set in concrete now. All he had to do was take it to the White House, and then after he got it approved, Fowler would go for this. Risks and all, distaste for covert operations and all, this was too juicy for the politician in him to turn down. And after Clark and Chavez brought it off, his stock would go up. And things would change. Things would get better. He would get things straightened out. For starters, he'd plan a vacation. It was time for one. A week off, maybe two. And if some CIA puke showed up with daily briefing documents, Ryan would kill the son of a bitch. He wanted freedom from the job, and he'd get it. 2 good weeks. Take the kids out of school and go see Mickey, just as Clark had suggested. He'd make the reservations tomorrow. I'm home, Jack announced. Silence. That was odd. He went downstairs and found the kids in front of the TV. They were doing too damn much of that, but that was their father's fault. He'd change that, too. He'd cut back on his hours. It was time Marcus held up his end instead of working banker's hours and leaving Jack with all the goddamn work. Where's Mommy? I don't know, Sally said, without turning away from the green slime and orange guck. Ryan walked back upstairs and into the bedroom to change. Still no sign of his wife. He found her carrying a basket of wash. Jack stood in her path, leaning forward to kiss her, but she leaned back and shook her head. Okay. That was no big thing. What's for dinner, babe? He inquired lightly. I don't know. Why don't you fix something? It was her tone, the snappy way she fired back without provocation. What did I do? Jack asked. He was already surprised, but he hadn't had time enough to grasp her demeanor. The look in her eyes was an alien thing, and when she answered to this question, her voice made him shrivel. Nothing, Jack. You haven't done anything at all. She pushed past him with the basket and disappeared around the corner. He just stood there, flat against the wall, his mouth open, not knowing what to say, and not understanding why his wife had suddenly decided to despise him. It took only a day and a half from Latakia to Piraeus. Bach had found a ship heading to the right port, eliminating the need to transship at Rotterdam. Kati disliked deviation from the plan, but a careful check of shipping schedules showed that the 5 days saved might be important, and he agreed to it. He and Gon watched the gantry crane lift up the cargo container and move it onto the deck of the Carmen Vita, a Greek flag container ship on the Mediterranean run. She would sail on the evening tide and arrive in the United States in 11 days. They could have chartered a jet aircraft and done this, Kati thought, but it would have been too dangerous. 11 days. He'd be able to see his physician again, and still have time to fly to America and make certain that all the arrangements were satisfactory. The workers secured the container box in place. It would be well protected in the center of the ship, with other boxes atop it, and well aft so that winter storms would not buffet it directly. The two men retired to a waterfront bar and waited for the ship to sail, then flew to Damascus and drove from there to their headquarters. The bomb shop was already gone. Mothballed would have been a more accurate term. The power cables had been cut and dirt pushed over all the entrances. If someone ever drove a heavy truck over the concealed roof, there would be a major surprise, but that was unlikely. It was possible that they might use the facility again, and against that slim possibility was the inconvenience of removing the machines to another burial place. Simply covering the facility over was the most logical alternative. Russell flew to Chicago to catch the first round of playoff games. He took with him a camera, an expensive Nikon F4, and burned up 2 rolls of ASA-100 color prints photographing the ABC trucks. The Monday night football team was doing this particular wild card game, before catching a cab back to the airport. He was lucky enough on the flight that he caught part of the game on the radio during the drive from Stapleton International to his new house off Interstate 76. The Bears pulled it out in overtime 23-20. That meant that Chicago would have the honor of losing the following week to the Vikings in the Metrodome. Minnesota had a bye during the first week of wild card games. Tony Will's pulled groin would be fully healed, and that rookie, the announcer pointed out, had barely missed making 2,000 rushing yards in his first NFL season, plus 800 yards as a receiver. Russell managed to catch nearly all of the AFC game because it was played on the West Coast. There were no surprises. But it was still football. USS Maine left the shed without incident. Tugs turned her around, pointing the submarine down the channel, and continued to stand by if assistance were required. Captain Ricks stood atop the sail, actually aft of the cockpit, leaning against rails set in the very top of the structure. Lieutenant Commander Claggett stood his watch in the control room. The navigator actually did the work, using the periscope to mark positions, which a quartermaster dutifully checked off on the chart, ensuring that the submarine was in the center of the channel and headed in the proper direction. The trip to sea was a fairly lengthy one. Throughout the boat, men continued to stow gear. Those not actually on watch settled into their bunks and tried to nap. Soon Maine would be on her regular 6-hour watch cycle. The sailors all made the conscious effort to get their minds from land mode into at-sea mode. Families and friends might as well have been on another planet. For the next 2 months, their entire world was contained within the steel hull of their submarine. Mancuso watched the sailing as he always did for each of his boats. It was a shame, he decided, that there was no way to get Ricks off the boat. But there was no such way. He'd meet with Group in a few days to go over routine business. At that meeting, he'd express his misgivings about Ricks. He would not be able to go too far this first time, just to let Group know that he had his doubts about the gold CO. The quasi-political nature of the exercise grated on Mancuso, who liked things in the open and above board, the Navy way. But the Navy way had its own rules of behavior, and in the absence of substantive cause for action, all he could do now was express concern with Ricks and his way of running things. Besides, Group was headed by yet another hyper-engineering type who would probably have a little too much sympathy with Harry. Mancuso tried to find an emotion for the moment, but failed. The slate-gray shape diminished in the distance, gliding across the oily, calm waters of the harbor, heading out for her 5th deterrence patrol, as U.S. Navy submarines had been doing for over 30 years. Business as usual, world changes and all, that's all it was. Maine sailed out to keep the peace through the threat of the most inhuman force known to man. The Commodore shook his head. What a hell of a way to run a railroad. That was why he'd always been a fast attack man. But it worked, had worked, probably would continue to work for a lot more years, Bart told himself, and while not every boomer skipper was another Mush Morton, they'd all brought their boats back. He got into his navy blue official car and told the driver to take him back to the office. Paperwork beckoned. At least the kids didn't notice. Jack took some comfort in that. Kids lived as spectators in a highly complex world which required years of schooling to appreciate, as a result of which they took note mainly of the parts that they understood, and that did not include a mom and dad who simply didn't talk. It wouldn't last forever, of course, but it might last long enough for things to be smoothed over. Probably would, Jack thought. Sure it would. He didn't know what was wrong, nor did he know what to do about it. What he ought to have done, of course, was get home at a decent hour, maybe take her out to dinner at a nice place, and... But that was not possible with two kids in school. Getting a sitter in the middle of the week and this far out of town was impractical. Another option was simply to get home and pay closer attention to his wife, leading to a... But he couldn't depend on his ability to do that, and one more failure could only make things worse. He looked up from his desk, out at the pines that lay beyond the CIA boundary fence. The symmetry was perfect. His work was messing up his family life, and now his family life was messing up his work. So now he had nothing at all that he could do properly. Wasn't that nice? Ryan got up from his desk and left the office, wandering to the nearest kiosk. Once there, he purchased his first pack of cigarettes in 5 years? Six? Whatever. He stripped off the cellophane top and tapped one out. One luxury of having a private office was that he could smoke without interference. CIA had become just like all government offices in that respect. For the most part, people could smoke only in the restrooms. He pretended not to see the disapproving look on Nancy's face on his way back in, then went rooting in his desk for an ashtray before lighting up. It was, he decided a minute later, just as the initial dizziness hit him, one of the dependable pleasures of life. Alcohol was another. You ingested these substances and you got the desired result, which explained their popularity in spite of the dangers to health that everyone knew about. Alcohol and nicotine, the two things that make intolerable life into something else. While they shortened it. Wasn't that just great? Ryan almost laughed at his incredible stupidity. Just what else of himself would he destroy? But did it matter? His work mattered. That he was sure of. That was what had landed him in this mess one way or another. That was the prime destructive factor in his life, but he could no more leave that than he could change anything else. Nancy, please ask Mr. Clark to come in. John appeared 2 minutes later. Ah, hell, Doc, he observed almost immediately. Now what's the wife gonna say? Not a thing. Bet you're wrong on that. Clark turned to open a window for ventilation. He'd quit a long time before. It was the one vice that he feared. It had killed his father. What do you want? How's the hardware? Waiting for your go-ahead to build it. Go, Jack said simply. You got a go-mission order? No, but I don't need it. We'll call it part of the feasibility study. How long to slap things together? 3 days, they say. We'll need some cooperation from the Air Force. What about the computer side? That program has already been validated. They've taken tapes from 6 different aircraft and smoothed out the noise. It's never taken them more than 2 or 3 hours to do an hour of tape. Mexico City to D.C. is, depending on weather, just under 4 hours max.
Doing the full tape will be an overnighter, Clark estimated. The president's schedule is what? Arrival ceremony is Monday afternoon. The first business session is the following morning. State dinner Tuesday night. You going? Ryan shook his head. No, we're going to the one a week earlier. Geez, that's not too far off, is it? I'll call the 89th Wing at Andrews. They do training hops all the time. Getting your team aboard won't be hard. I have 3 capture teams selected. They're all ex-Air Force and Navy ELINT spooks, Clark said. They know the business. Okay. Run with it. You got it, Doc. Jack watched him leave and lit up another.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
The Sum of All Fears by Tom Clancy.
Chapter 29. Crossroads. MV Carmen Vita cleared the Strait of Gibraltar right on schedule, her peel stick diesels driving her at a constant 19 knots. The crew of 40 officers and men. This ship did not have any women in the crew, though 3 of the officers had their wives with them, settled down for the normal sailing routine of watchkeeping and maintenance. They were 7 days out from the Virginia Capes. On her deck and stowed below were a goodly number of standard-sized container boxes. These actually came in 2 sizes, and they were all loaded with various types of cargo which the captain and crew neither knew nor cared very much about. The whole point of containerization was that the ship was used exclusively as a contract hauler, much as a trucker was used by various businesses. All the ship's crew needed to worry about was the weight of the containers, and that always seemed to work out rather uniformly, since the containers themselves were always loaded to reflect what a commercial truck could legally pull along a public highway. The ship's southerly routing also made for a fairly sedate and uneventful passage. The really bitter winter storms followed a more northerly track, and the ship's master, a native of India, was happy for it. A youngish man for such a substantial command, he was only 37, he knew that good weather made for a fast and fuel-efficient voyage. He aspired to a larger and more sumptuous ship, and by keeping Carmen Vita on the schedule and under budget, he'd get that in due course. It was the 10th day in a row that Clark hadn't seen Mrs. Ryan. John Clark had a good memory for such things, honed by years of field operations of one sort or another in which one stayed alive by keeping track of everything, whether it seemed important or not. He'd never seen her more than 2 in a row. Jack worked an inconvenient schedule, but so did she, with early morning surgery at least 2 a week. And she was awake this morning. He saw her head through the kitchen window, sitting at a table, probably drinking coffee and reading the paper or watching TV. But she hadn't even turned her head to look at her husband when he left, had she? Ordinarily, she got up to kiss him goodbye like any wife. 10 days in a row. Not a good sign, was it? What was the problem? Jack came out to the car, his face dark and looking down. There was the grimace again. Morning, Doc, Clark greeted him cheerily. Hi, John, was the subdued reply. He hadn't brought his paper again, either. He started reading from the dispatch box, as usual, and by the time they reached the D.C. Beltway, he'd just be staring, a grim 1,000-yard stare in his eyes as he lit a continuous chain of cigarettes. Clark decided that he just couldn't stand it anymore. Problem at home, Doc? He asked quietly, watching the road. Yeah. But it's my problem. Guess so. The kids are okay? It's not the kids, John. Leave it, okay? Right. Clark concentrated on his driving while Ryan went through the message traffic. What the hell is the problem? Be analytical, Clark told himself. Think it through. His boss had been depressed for over a month now. But it had really gotten worse. The news article. That thing from Holtzman? A family problem, not involving the kids. That meant trouble with the wife. He made a mental note to recheck that piece and any subsequent pieces when he got into the office. 70 minutes after picking Ryan up, traffic was light this morning. He headed for CIA's rather impressive library and got the staff there busy. It wasn't hard for them. The agency kept a special file for all the pieces that concerned it, arranged in folders by the author's bylines. The problem, Clark thought, was immediately clear. Boltzmann had talked about financial and sexual misconduct. Right after that article came out.
Oh, shit, Clark whispered to himself. He made copies of the various recent pieces. There were 4 of them, and went for a walk to clear his head. One nice thing about being a SPO, especially a SPO assigned to Ryan, was that he had very little work to do. Ryan was a homebody while in Langley. He didn't really move around all that much. As he took a quick walking tour of the grounds, he reread the news articles and made another connection. The Sunday piece. Ryan had gone home early that day. He'd been upbeat, talking about getting away right after the Mexican job, taking John's advice for a trip to Florida. But the next morning, he'd looked like a corpse, and he wasn't bringing the paper out with him. His wife must have been reading it, and something had gone very bad between Ryan and his wife. That seemed reasonably clear. Clear enough for Clark. Clark came back into the building, going through the normal routine of passing through the computer-controlled gates, then setting off to locate Chavez, who was in the new headquarters building. John found him in an office, going over schedules. Ding, get your coat. 10 minutes later, they were on the DC Beltway. Chavez was checking a map. Okay, Chavez said. I have it. Broadway and Monument, up from the harbor. Russell was dressed in coveralls. The photos of the ABC vans in Chicago had turned out very well, and he'd had a lab in Boulder blow them up to poster size. These he compared to his van. It was exactly the same model of utility van, to make precise measurements. What came next wasn't easy. He'd purchased 12 large sheets of semi-rigid plastic, and he began carving them to make an exact match of the ABC logo. As he finished each, he taped it to the side of his van and used a marker pencil to scribe in the letters. It required 6 attempts to get it right, and Russell next used the knife to make reference marks on the van. It seemed a pity to score the paint on the van, but he reminded himself that the van would be blown up anyway, and there was no sense in getting sentimental about a truck. On the whole, he was proud of his artistic talents. He hadn't had a chance to exercise them since he'd learned a trade in the prison shop many years before. When the logo was painted on, black letters on a white-painted truck, nobody would be able to tell the difference. The next job of the day was to drive to the local motor vehicle agency to get commercial tags for the van. He explained that he would use it for his electronics business, installing and servicing commercial phone systems. He walked out with temporary tags, and they promised delivery of the real ones in 4 working days, which struck Russell as unnecessarily efficient. Getting the license was even easier. The international licensing documents that Gohn had provided to go along with his passport were honored by the state of Colorado after he passed a written test, and he had a photo-certified license card to go along with the tags. His only mistake was messing up one of the forms, but the clerk let him sign a fresh one while Russell dumped the first in the trash can. Or appeared to. The blank form slid into the pocket of his parka. Johns Hopkins Hospital is not located in the best of neighborhoods. As compensation for that fact, the Baltimore City Police guarded it in a way that reminded Clark of his time in Vietnam. He found a parking place on Broadway, just across from the main entrance. Then he and Chavez went in, walking around the marble statue of Jesus, which both found rather admirable in size and execution. The large complex, Hopkins, is a vast facility, made finding the right part difficult, but 10 minutes later they were sitting outside the Wilmer Eye Institute office of Associate Professor Carolyn M. Ryan, M.D., F.A.C.S. Clark relaxed and read a magazine, while Chavez cast his lecherous dark eyes on the receptionist, whom Mrs. Ryan evidently rated. The other, Dr. Ryan, as Clark thought of her, showed up at 12:35 with an armful of documents. She gave the two CIA officers a who-are-you look and breezed into her office without a word. It didn't take much of a look on his part, either. She'd always appeared to him a very attractive and dignified female. Not now. Her face, if anything, was in worse shape than her husband's. This really was getting out of hand, John thought. Clark gave it a 10 count and just walked past the open-mouthed receptionist to begin his newest career, marriage counselor. "What is this?" Kathy asked. "I don't have any appointments today." "Ma'am, I need a few minutes of your time." "Who are you? Are you going to ask me about Jack?" "Ma'am, my name is Clark." He reached into his shirt pocket and pulled out the card-sized CIA photo pass, attached, as most were, to a metal chain that went around his neck. "There may be some things you need to know about." Kathy's eyes went hard almost at once, the anger taking over from the hurt. "I know," she said. "I've heard it all." "No, ma'am, I think that you do not know. This isn't a good place to talk. May I invite you to lunch?" "Around here? The streets aren't all that safe." Clark smiled to show just how absurd her observation was. For the first time, Carolyn Ryan applied a professional eye to her visitor. He was about Jack's height, but bulkier. Whereas she had once found her husband's face manly, Clark's was rugged. His hands looked large and powerful, and his body language proclaimed that he could deal with anything. More impressive was his demeanor. The man could have intimidated almost anyone, she realized, but he was going out of his way to appear gentlemanly, and succeeding, like the ballplayers who sometimes came here to see the kids. Teddy bear was what she thought. Not because he was, but because he wanted to be.
"There's a place right down Monument Street."
"Fine." Clark turned and lifted her overcoat from the clothes tree. He held it almost daintily for her to put it on. Chavez joined them outside. He was much smaller than Clark, but more overtly dangerous, like a gang kid who was trying to smooth off his edges. Chavez, she saw, took the lead as they walked outside, preceding them up the sidewalk in a way that was almost comical. The streets here were not what she thought safe, at least not for a woman walking alone, though that was more a problem at night than during the day, but Chavez moved like a man in battle. That, she thought, was interesting. They found the small restaurant quickly, and Clark steered everyone into a corner booth. Both the men had their backs to the wall so that they could stare outward at any incoming threat. Both had their coats unbuttoned, though they both seemed outwardly relaxed.
"Who exactly are you?" she asked.
The whole affair was like something from a bad movie.
"I'm your husband's driver," John replied. "I'm a field officer, paramilitary type. I've been with the agency for almost 20 years.
"You're not supposed to tell people stuff like that."
Clark just shook his head.
"Ma'am, we haven't even started breaking laws yet. Now I'm mainly a security and protective officer, a SPO. Ding Chavez here is also at SPO.
"Hello, Dr. Ryan. My real name is Domingo."
He held out his hand.
"I work with your husband also. John and I drive him around and protect him on trips and stuff."
"You're both carrying guns?"
Ding almost looked embarrassed.
"Yes, ma'am."
With that, the adventurous part of the meeting ended, Kathy thought. Two obviously very tough men were trying to charm her. They had even succeeded. But that didn't change her problem. She was about to say something, but Clark started off first.
"Ma'am, there seems to be a problem between you and your husband. I don't know what it is. I think I know some of it, but I do know that it's hurting the guy. That's bad for the agency."
"Gentlemen, I appreciate your concern, but this is a private matter.
Yes, ma'am, Clark responded in his eerily polite voice. He reached into his pocket and pulled out Xerox copies of the Holtzman articles. Is this the problem?
That's not any of your...
Her mouth clamped shut. I thought so. Ma'am, none of this is true. I mean the sexual impropriety part. That's definitely not true. Your husband hardly goes anywhere without one of us. Because of where he works and who he is, he has to sign out for every place he goes to. Like a doctor on call, okay? If you want, I can get you copies of his itinerary for as far back as you want.
That can't be legal.
No, it probably isn't, Clark agreed. So? She so wanted to believe, Kathy thought. But she couldn't, and it was best to tell them why.
Look, your loyalty to Jack is very impressive. But I know, okay? I went through the financial records, and I know about that Zimmer woman, and I know about the kid.
What exactly do you know?
I know that Jack was there for the delivery. I know about the money, and how he tried to hide it from me and everybody else. I know that he's being investigated by the government.
What do you mean?
A government investigator was here at Hopkins. I know that.
Dr. Ryan, there is no such investigation at CIA, and no investigation at the FBI either. That's a fact.
Then who was here?
I'm afraid I don't know that, Clark answered. It wasn't entirely true, but Clark figured this lie was not pertinent to the matter at hand.
Look, I know about Carol Zimmer, she said again.
What do you know? Clark repeated quietly. The response he got surprised him. The answer almost came out as a scream.
Jack's playing around, and she's the one. And there's a kid involved, and Jack is spending so much time with her that he doesn't have any time for me, and he can't even...
She stopped at the point of sobbing. Clark waited for her to settle down. His eyes didn't leave her face for an instant, and he saw it all as clearly as though it had been printed on a page. Ding merely looked embarrassed. He wasn't old enough to understand. Will you hear me through?
Sure. Why not? It's over. The only reason I haven't just walked out is the kids. So go ahead, make your pitch. Tell me that he still loves me and all that. He doesn't have the guts to talk about it to me himself, but I'm sure he had something to do with this, she concluded bitterly.
First of all, he does not know we are here. If he finds out, I'll probably lose my job. But that's no big thing. I have my retirement. Besides, I'm about to break bigger rules than that one. Where do I begin? Clark paused before going on. Carol Zimmer is a widow. Her husband was Chief Master Sergeant Buck Zimmer, U.S. Air Force. He died in the line of duty. As a matter of fact, he died in your husband's arms. I know. I was there. Buck took 5 rounds in the chest, both lungs. It took him 5 or 6 minutes to die. He left behind 7 children. 8, if you count the one his wife was carrying. Buck didn't know about that one when he died. Carol was waiting to surprise him. Sergeant Zimmer was the crew chief of an Air Force Special Operations helicopter. We took that aircraft into a foreign country to rescue a group of U.S. Army soldiers who were conducting a covert mission.
I was one of them, ma'am, Ding announced, somewhat to Clark's displeasure. I wouldn't be here if the doc hadn't put it out on the line.
The soldiers had been deliberately cut off from support from this end of the operation.
Who?
He's dead now, Clark answered in a way that left no doubt at all. Your husband uncovered what was an illegal operation. He and Dan Murray of the FBI set up the rescue mission. It was a bad one, really tough,
We were very lucky to get it done. I'm surprised you haven't noticed something. Nightmares, maybe.
He doesn't sleep well.
Well, yes, sometimes he...
Dr. Ryan missed having a bullet take his head off by, oh, maybe 2 inches, maybe 3. We had to rescue a squad of soldiers off a hilltop, and they were under attack. Jack worked one machine gun. Buck Zimmer had another one. Buck took hits as we lifted out, went down hard. Jack and I tried to help him, but I don't think even you Hopkins guys could have done very much. It wasn't real pretty. He died. Clark stopped for a moment, and Kathy could see that he wasn't faking the pain. He was talking about his kids. Worried about him, like any man would be. Your husband held Zimmer in his arms and promised him that he would look after them, that he'd see they were all educated, that he would take care of the family. Ma'am, I've been in this business a long time, back before you learned how to drive a car, okay? I've never seen anything better than what Jack did. After we got back, Jack did what he promised. I mean, of course. I'm not surprised he kept it a secret from you. There are aspects to the total operation that I do not know myself. But this much I do know. That man gives his word, he keeps it. I helped. We got the family moved up here from Florida. He set them up a little business. One of the kids is already in college at Georgetown, and the second oldest is already accepted into MIT. I forgot to tell you, Carol Zimmer, well, Carol ain't her name. She was born in Laos. Zimmer got her out when everything went to hell there, married her, and they started punching out kids like movie tickets. Anyway, she's a typical Asian mom. She thinks education is a gift from God himself, and those kids really study hard. They all think your husband's a saint. We stop in to see them at least once a week, every week.
I want to believe you, Kathy said. What about the baby?
You mean when it was born? Yeah. We were both there. My wife was the coach for the delivery. Jack didn't think it was right for him to be in the room, and I've never been there for one. It kinda scares me, Clark admitted. So we waited in the usual place with all the other wimps. If you want, I can introduce you to the Zimmer family. You can also confirm the story through Dan Murray at the FBI, if you think that is necessary.
Won't that get you into trouble?
Kathy knew at once that she could trust Murray. He was straight-laced on moral issues. It came from being a cop. I will definitely lose my job. I suppose they could prosecute me. Technically, I have just committed a federal felony, but I doubt it would go that far. Ding would lose his job, too, because he hasn't had the sense to keep his mouth shut like I told him to.
Shit, Ding commented. Then looked embarrassed. Excuse me, ma'am.
John, this is a matter of honor. Except for the doc, I'd be fertilizer on some Colombian hilltop. I owe him my life. That counts more than a job, Mono.
Clark handed over an index card. These are the dates of the operation. You may remember that when Admiral Greer died, Jack didn't make the funeral.
Yes. Bob Ritter called me, and
that's when it was. You can verify all of this with Mr. Murray.
God.
It all hit her at once. Yes, ma'am. All the garbage in these articles, it's all a lie.
Who's doing it?
I don't know, but I am going to find out. Doctor, I've been watching your guy come apart for the past 6 months. I've seen it happen before, in combat. I spent quite some time in Vietnam,
but this has been worse. That Vatican Treaty, the way the Middle East is settling down, Jack had a big part in that, but he isn't getting any credit at all.